And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have two arguments scheduled for Zoom Gov hearings today, today being April 22nd, 2021. Our host previously gave you some information to use for your guidance. We do have a timer. For me, it appears in the upper left-hand square. We also have lights that are affixed to that timer that will remind you when red is red, and your time has run out, but it will change to yellow and then of course to red. Also, please remember to state who you are speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument and presentation. With that said, I'm gonna ask our marshal to call court to order.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Johnson, Judge Gaetis, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
And Mr. Fink, if you'll also call the first case for hearing and presentation.
Now calling case number A201318, Carter Justice versus Marvel LLC, doing business as Pump It Up Parties.
And appellate counsel, when you're ready to proceed, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Mahesha Subbaraman, and together with my co-counsel of record, it is my privilege to represent appellant Carter Justice before this court. This case is about every parent's worst nightmare come true. Carter Justice was 7 years old when he fell from an inflatable amusement maintained by respondent Pump It Up. Carter suffered brain trauma because Pump It Up took no steps whatsoever to install safety mats around the amusement, a simple common sense safety measure. This appeal now concerns whether Pump It Up may escape liability for that astonishing disregard of child safety based on a pre-injury liability waiver that Carter's mother signed on Carter's behalf. The vast majority of jurisdictions have ruled that parents do not have the ability to waive the tort claims of children under circumstances materially identical to those at issue here. Minnesota common law, in turn, establishes that absent a statute, parents cannot even sue on behalf of their children, much less waive tort claims before any injury has occurred. It is then Pump It Up's burden to point to a Minnesota statute that expressly authorizes parents to execute pre-injury liability waivers on behalf of children, and Pump It Up cites no such statute. But the court doesn't have to get to any of that to decide this case. The parties entered into a post-injury agreement that modifies the pre-injury waiver. This court's case law is absolutely clear that contract modification is a fact question for a jury. Now, if the court decides to move past that, appellant provides four additional reasons why the Minnesota law does not permit enforcement of the pre-injury liability waiver issue here.
Let's back up and go over some of that, because first of all, we're all aware that the waiver was signed in 07. We're familiar with the facts that are in the record. The law wasn't passed until 2010. Obviously, the law is not retroactive unless it's specifically stated. How do you compensate for that? How do you urge us as a reviewing court to ignore that very basic requirement of laws being enacted?
Well, Your Honor, we're not asking you to ignore that principle at all. We're simply asking you to appreciate the distinction between retroactive enforcement and prospective enforcement. And respectfully, our leading submission to the court in our opening brief is that this is a case of prospective enforcement, not retroactivity. And I think the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in the Tapia case provides helpful illumination on that point. What that case emphasizes is that it's the time when whether it's an agreement or a document or a right is being enforced, that's the relevant starting point for looking at if a party is applying to enforce something, what is the law at that time? And the fact is, Pump It Up did not apply to enforce the agreement here until 2020, long after the statute at issue had been passed. And
to
so
me, that appears to create nothing but chaos in terms of our tort litigation, because we never have any conclusion of any cases, because at any time with the prospective approach, you could open up litigation. I mean, to me, it just seems to create confusion.
Well, Your Honor, I think that there is another way to come at this if you want to kind of look at it in terms of whether there is confusion or not. Because in this case, we're dealing with a unique circumstance. We're dealing with an exculpatory agreement that was signed on behalf of a child. Now, the doctrine of prospectivity versus retroactivity makes clear that you don't have retroactivity unless you're upsetting a vested right. And here, we could not have a vested right in this exculpatory agreement for two reasons. One, it's being executed on behalf of a minor, and it's well established under Minnesota law that a minor can disaffirm contracts that have been signed on their behalf upon turning to the age of majority, turning 18. So there's no way that Pump It Up could say we can count on this agreement until Carter turned 18 and ratified the agreement, which he did not do. And then additionally, we have under Minnesota law, the fact that an exculpatory agreement can be invalidated at any time by a court if it determines that that agreement violates public policy. And that's an inherently retroactive judgment if you think about it, and you look at the cases where the Minnesota Supreme Court and this court have invalidated such exculpatory clauses. The court has gone back and said, well, maybe that agreement was signed 5 or 10 years ago, but it's against public policy. We're not going to enforce it. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has never said, well, that's chaos we're not prepared to admit. Rather, it has emphasized that exculpatory clauses are disfavored under Minnesota law. And precisely because of that fact, no vested rights can arise in them.
I just want to make sure that I understand your public policy argument in relation to the statute. Are you arguing that even if the court concludes that the statute is not retroactive in its application, that it identifies the state's policy with regard to waivers when it comes to inflatables?
That's correct, Your Honor. We make this point in discussing the Minnesota common law on exculpatory clauses, and that common law makes clear that if an exculpatory clause violates public policy, then it's void. And we have the unique circumstance here of the legislature expressly saying that these types of liability waivers violate public policy and are void. So with the legislature having spoken on the subject, this court's job is to follow the lead of the legislature, not to thwart that will and to complicate a scheme that the legislature enacted in good faith.
But the Schlobum case specifies two inquiries to determine public policy, whether there was unequal bargaining power and the nature of the services. How do we know the legislature answered those questions when it enacted the statute?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that the legislature has to go about answering the question in the same way that courts answer the question. The reason that the courts have articulated those tests is because they recognize they're operating in an area of common law, and they're essentially trying to guess what the legislature intent would be. But here, no guesswork is required. The legislature has said, we don't like these liability waivers. They are void. And as a Minnesota Supreme Court said, and I believe like it was a 1932 case that we cite in our briefing, when the legislature speaks, it's not the jobs of courts to kind of second guess that. It's to listen and to follow what the legislature has said.
I have a stepping back a bit to a more general question. Is it your position that Carter's mother could have commenced this suit on his behalf before he turned 18?
No. Well, we have Minnesota Statute 540. 0.08, which says that parents can raise claims on behalf of their children. So the answer to that question is yes, under Minnesota statutory law, that's permitted. But what those statutes prove by implication is statute saying that she could.
I guess maybe to be more specific, in light of the waiver that she signed before the injury, is it your position that despite that, she could still have gone to court on his behalf while he was still a minor?
Well, the answer to that question is yes, because the waiver is unenforceable under Minnesota law unless you have a statute authorizing that type of agreement. And we don't have that. And you can look at that through the lens of, is there a statute authorizing it? But you can also look at it through the lens of the law of infants contracts, because it's important to recognize that the way that Pump It Up is trying to enforce the waiver here is different than other cases that this court has encountered, where it's usually a parent signs the waiver and then the parent sues and the court is confronted with the question of whether the waiver is effectively enforceable against the parent. Here, we're dealing with a child who has sued upon turning 18. And in the Scholes case, this court recognized that a 17-year-old who signs an agreement, an exculpatory clause, turns 18, they are entitled to disaffirm that agreement. So if Carter's mother is signing this agreement on Carter's behalf, as if it were Carter's signature on that page, the same principle applies. And if the court reaches an opposite conclusion, then in effect, what it would be saying is that the law of infants contracts protects 17-year-olds who can do the handwork of signing more than it protects 7-year-olds who can't.
I mean, isn't again, speaking generally, isn't it true that parents frequently enter into contracts on behalf of their children or agreements in multiple forms? I mean, you know, one that comes to mind is medical care. You know, if the child is the patient, now perhaps there are, you know, fees for services, or perhaps maybe the parents are obligated, but when it comes to, say, consent to a surgery, for example, parents give the consent routinely on behalf of the child. So, I mean, where do we draw lines here between what parents may do and what third parties may rely on as enforceable and what they may not?
I think the way that you answer that question here is twofold. First, you look at the Minnesota common law and the principles that it has stated in this area. And for well over 100 years, what the Minnesota Supreme Court has affirmed time and again is that without a statute, a parent could not sue on behalf of a child. Now, if you need a statute to sue, then you likewise need a statute to waive. And here, Pump It Up does not cite any statute whatsoever that authorizes the pre-injury waiver at issue. So I think that is first and foremost the principle the court should look at. The other principle that the court can and should look at is the principle of infants' contracts, because what they're trying to do here is take an agreement signed on Carter's behalf in Carter's name and enforce it against Carter, not just against the parent. And to the extent that that's the case, the principle of infants' contracts makes clear that when a child turns 18, they are fully empowered to disaffirm any contracts that have been entered by themselves or on their behalf. And to the extent that that's exactly what we're dealing with here, then Carter Justice deserves the exact same protection as the 17-year-old kid in the Scholes case received.
I'd like to draw your attention to Section 604.055. You've cited it in your reply brief, I think. And I think you might have been referring to Subdivision 1, so I don't know if you've memorized this statute or not. But Subdivision 2 defines party or parties to include, quote, a minor or another who is authorized to sign or accept the agreement on behalf of the minor, end quote. I mean, so... And this statute became effective in 2013, but doesn't that definition essentially acknowledge that there are some people who are authorized to sign agreements such as this on behalf of minors?
Well, there are two points there that the court should be cognizant of. To the extent that you want to view that statute as any kind of authorization, as you pointed out, it was passed in 2013. And if you look at the effective date language of that provision, it says that it only applies to agreements entered into on or after that date. So by necessary implication, before that date, there was no right by parents to be able to enter into agreements in this context. So that's one key point. But the other key point, I think, look at Subdivision 3. Subdivision 3 says that this provision does not prevent liability waiver addressing this subject from being invalidated under any other Minnesota law. So all the legislature was doing with this provision was saying, we're carving out waivers that deal with greater than ordinary negligence. And to the extent that those waivers exist, whether signed by parents or signed by children, they are unenforceable. But there may be other provisions in Minnesota law that independently render them unenforceable, and we're keeping that law in effect as well. And that's the clear import of Subdivision 3. Your Honors, unless you have any further questions, I'm happy to discuss some of the alternative arguments that we raise, or to move on to the punitive damages question if the court has any questions on that point.
I have one more question. Now I'm referring to the statute. I forgot the number. I don't know, 184B20, the statute specifically about inflatables. Doesn't the enactment of that statute imply that the provisions of law there were not pre-existing in the common law before the enactment of the statute?
Well, I think that what that statute points to more than anything else is that the legislature is active in this area. And to the extent that we're asking the question, can a parent do something, we need statutory authority. And if you're going to rely on 184.B.20, the legislature's made clear that at least in this area, parents don't have the ability to execute waivers on behalf of children. And I think that that statement by the legislature is consistent with the common law as recognized going back over 100 years by the Minnesota Supreme Court. If you don't have a statute, then you cannot, as a parent, bind your child unilaterally.
But if it was consistent with the common law, then why was it necessary to enact it?
Well, sometimes the legislature wants to enact additional protections. I mean, if the legislature tomorrow enacts a provision forbidding racial covenants, recognizing that a lot of those covenants are still on the books in a variety of contexts, well, we know that those covenants are illegal and unenforceable and violations of equal protection, but the legislature, through a belt and suspenders approach, may well want to double up on the protection and really sink home the fact that these provisions should not be entered into and will not be enforced in Minnesota. Your Honor, I see my time is ticking down. Briefly on the punitive damages point, because I do want to touch on that. The court below misweighed the evidence. Instead of viewing the punitive damages record through the lens of, is there a prima facie case taking everything as true, it decided to weigh the evidence on whether there was a high risk of injury. That was error on its part and constitutes a basis for reversal on that ground.
What evidence? That's what I'd like to know. You made some generalizations, but what evidence was presented or preserved at trial court as far as the sufficiency for this, for punitive damages?
Well, Your Honor, I see my time has run out, but if I may briefly answer that question.
Yes,
there were three principal pieces of evidence that were presented below. First, we have Pump It Up's own self-stated duty in their handbook saying we have a duty to be fanatical about the safety of our guests. Second, we have their efforts to identify an approved safety mat vendor, and not just a vendor of any safety mats, but custom safety mats. So a recognition on their part that there is a risk here to children. And the district court below credited that point and said there might be an inference, but then it refused to make that inference because again, it was weighing the evidence rather than accepting it as true. And then finally, Your Honor, we have the interrogatory responses from Pump It Up saying that they essentially took no measures whatsoever to protect the safety of children before or after Carter's fall in terms of safety training, in terms of determining what it would cost to install mats, et cetera, et cetera. That amounts to a deliberate disregard for the safety of children when all taken as true and viewed through a prima facie light.
Any other questions, judges? All right, then thank you. You'll have your 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll turn it over to respondent counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joe Nyland. I represent the defendant Marvel LLC, DBA, Pump It Up. This is an interesting oral argument. It is nothing like what happened at the trial court level. Most of the discussion that we just had did not happen at the trial court level. I argued the case at the trial court level. None of these issues came up.
No, you're not saying we're unusual or different. What I'm hearing you say is that the record wasn't preserved or wasn't raised below adequately for us to examine it.
That's the unusual nature of the argument. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Nyland, I think it's worth maybe exploring that at the outset, because I've looked at the record, looked at the memorandum that plaintiffs submitted in opposition to your motion. And just to make a statement more than a question, my impression was that the new statute 184B.20 was mentioned briefly. There was also a very brief, somewhat indirect reference to a parent's authority to sign waivers in general. And those were not thoroughly developed, certainly not like they are now on appeal, but the district court did address those matters. In other words, the district court felt like they were raised in a sufficiently clear way that she went ahead and talked about them. So, I think this is one area where we give deference to the district court's interpretation of the arguments that have been presented. Would you disagree with what I've said?
I agree with everything you said, Your Honor. In particular, the lack of focus on the issues. Yes, there was a sentence in the brief about parental authority. Yes, there was a brief discussion of 184B. No, these issues were not raised. And that's where I draw the distinction.
Well, then why did the district judge discuss them?
Probably out of an abundance of caution, Your Honor. But let me address them. We're talking about them, so let me address them.
And before you go further, I will say I would agree with you with respect to the argument. I mean, at least my view at the moment is that there was no argument in the district court about that there's evidence in the record of greater than ordinary negligence that should cause the motion for summary judgment to be denied. I mean, it seems fairly clear to me that that argument was not made below. But otherwise, anyway, that's my, I'm speaking, of course, only for myself at the moment. But anyway.
Sure. You may proceed. With regard to parental authority, what appellant is asking the court to do is turn the existing common law on its head and require the legislature to pass specific authorizations for parents to act on their behalf. And as the court's already correctly pointed out, parents routinely do that, whether it's in medical things, whether it's school events, whether it's recreational activities, whether it's sporting activities, parents always are required to sign authorizations, waivers for all of those activities. And what counsel has suggested to the court is that unless there's a statute that says parents can sign a consent form for this child to have surgery, it's unenforceable and that doctor is exposed to liability. That's just backwards. And there's a number of cases that we've cited in our briefs that talk about it in a variety of different contexts. In contrast, appellant has not cited a single case to the contrary. The cases that he cites, O'Brien and Corsell, do not involve a parent signing a waiver on behalf of a child. It's either a child signing a waiver on its own behalf or a parent signing a contract. It's not a parent signing a waiver on behalf of a child. That's in contrast to the Minnesota Baseball Instructional School, Salinger, the Plymouth Youth Baseball, Christensen. All of these cases are in our brief. The second thing, Judge, and the court, you hit on it with regard to 604.055. There's an implicit recognition that the existing common law is parents may sign waivers on behalf of their children. That's what that subdivision 2 says. In addition, if you look at section 540.08, settlement authority, what the legislature did there, it didn't authorize the parents to enter into a settlement agreement. It limited their authority to do so. That's the inverse of what the plaintiff is, of what appellant is suggesting. 540.08 limits the parent's authority to enter into the settlement agreement. It doesn't authorize it. One other point on parental authority. If this court takes what I think would be an extraordinary step and what I think would open a floodgate of litigation and holds that in order for a parent to sign a waiver on behalf of a child, there has to be a statute authorizing it. That's new law. And when you create new law, you need to look closely at the Hoff v. Kempton case about whether you can apply that decision to this case. And I would submit to the court that this case, if you go down that road, would involve a case of first impression, new precedent. It would require retroactive application. All of the standards that Hoff v. Kempton, our Supreme Court says, you should look at in determining whether or not to apply it to our circumstance. I think that those factors weigh in favor of not applying your decision retroactively. With regard to 184B.20, you know, the court correctly points out that there's a clear statute, 645.21, the presumption against retroactive effect of a statute. And the statute's awfully clear. It says, unless clearly and manifestly so intended by the legislature. Here, we don't have that. 184B has nothing in there that manifestly, clearly and manifestly demonstrates the legislature's intent to make it retroactive. Candidly, I had a hard time following appellant's argument that, well, this is a progressive looking application. It's not retroactive, it's proactive. And I started thinking about that, and it just doesn't make any sense to me, because all contracts, when they're signed and executed, establish the rights of the parties. If you have to wait until a court decides the case 3 years, 6 years, in this case, 19, 20 years later, you're not providing any of the certainty that contracts provide. So I'm not following that argument very well.
Mr. Nyland, I wonder if I could direct you to the issue of the breadth or ambiguity or lack thereof of the, this is an issue where there's fairly well-established case law, Schlobohm and the cases that follow Schlobohm. So it seems to me that, if I've read it carefully multiple times, the release here does not use the word negligence. It uses broader language talking about, I'm speaking generally, all claims, blah, blah, blah. The case law, which has held agreements enforceable, I think almost always those cases are reviewing agreements that specifically use the word negligence in some way so as to allow the court to say it's limited to negligence. I'm thinking of Beener, Maleka, Anderson. Those are court of appeals cases. I think Schlobohm itself. How do you fit this case, your waiver, into that case law? Or is there other case law that's broader than that that encompasses your waiver?
No, I understand your question, Judge. Let me first tell you that when I was getting ready for the oral argument, I was looking at appellant's addendum, and I was looking at a copy of the waiver in question, and it was very blurry. That same document can be found on Doc 36. It was submitted to the trial court as an attachment to an affidavit. It's Doc 36. So it's a little bit easier to read. And in there, Judge, the word negligence is mentioned. It's mentioned in the context of other participants' negligence. But to get to your point directly, none of the cases, starting with Schlobohm, going through Maleka, going through Anderson, none of those cases say you have to have the word negligence in there. They look at the whole body of it in the context of what is being addressed and what is trying to be permitted or remedied. And if you read the language in those waivers, particularly Schlobohm, it's very, very broad. The word negligence pops up towards the end of that waiver, but the beginning part of it is the broad, all claims arising out of, relating to, very broad language. I have not, to put a very fine point on it, I haven't seen a case where the word negligence does not appear in the waiver itself. But the opinions of the courts that have looked at those have not focused exclusively on one word in the body or in the context of a very much longer waiver. Does that address your question, Your Honor?
I think so. Now I'm wondering where I've, I mean, I, I'm, the photocopy you mentioned is difficult to read, but I assume the way, I don't know where I read this waiver, but it's been reprinted somewhere in the briefs, I assume, and that's where I'm, but does the word negligence appear? I guess I need to be.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll quote it to you. It's in the third full paragraph. It says, on behalf of myself and the participant named below, knowingly and freely assume all such risks, both known and unknown, including those that may arise out of the negligence of other participants. That's in the third full paragraph of the subject waiver that we're talking about.
Is there anything which waives a claim against Pump It Up or Marvel for Marvel's negligence?
It does not specifically refer to Marvel's negligence.
I'm looking, and now I'm looking at page 4 of your own brief. You've got a block quote in the middle of the page there, which, and I mean, that I think is what I was familiar with before the argument, and I don't see the word negligence there. I think that's the portion that speaks to the conduct of Marvel.
You know, candidly, Judge, if I had to write that specific paragraph over, I'm serious. When I was getting ready for the oral argument, I looked at that, and the introductory language, which I haven't referred the court to yet, is as important as some of these other sections. So I would urge the court to read the waiver in its entirety. Take a look at document 36, and it's a little bit clearer. Keep in mind, Judge, that this is something that was signed back in 2007. It took us over a year during the litigation process to even find it. So it was buried in records. We were able to locate it. Appellant verified that that's her signature and so on.
I thought you were going to say, Mr. Nyland, that you would have drafted the release differently if you'd had a chance, which I probably goes without saying. But anyway, I apologize for my reaction.
One last comment, Judge, about the agreement somehow modifying the waiver. The parties are different. The waiver is parents, natural guardians, individually and on behalf of Carter Justice. That's the waiver. The agreement is between the parents and my client for the reimbursement of medical expenses. Carter Justice as a juvenile isn't part of that agreement. They're two separate parties. So to say that one modifies the other, it doesn't make any sense. Thanks, I've run out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. And back to appellant's counsel for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great.
Yeah.
So I just want to cover three brief points in the time that we have here. First, I want to emphasize liability waivers are different. In the colloquies that have occurred thus far, I think that there's been questioning about how a decision here would affect a wide array of documents that parents sign on behalf of children. And there's no question, there are authorization forms, permission slips, et cetera, et cetera. And we're not arguing that you need statute for every single thing. But what we are arguing is that when it comes to a pre-injury liability waiver, that is something that you need authorization for. And there are three clear places that the court can look in our briefing for confirmation of that point. First, look at our reply brief and the ALR article that we cite, which says, generally, a parent cannot compromise or release a minor child's cause of action absent statutory authority. Now, that's the common law rule throughout the United States. The court would not be flipping anything on its head to affirm that rule. And the second place the court should look at in this regard is look at something like the Mattson case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, decided at the turn of the 1900s. And what the court said in that case is that a tort claim on behalf of a child is a property right. and therefore is to be accorded full protection under the law. And in that case, the court was stressing, generally speaking, the protections that are owed to children. So that then finally gives us the other area of law that is of critical importance here, which is the law of infants' contracts, which doesn't enter into anywhere of opposing counsel's analysis. They simply look past the fact that even if you believe parents can sign things on behalf of children, children have the power to disaffirm when they turn 18. And that's the situation that we're dealing with here. And it would turn the law of infants' contracts on its head for this court to conclude that Carter cannot disaffirm an agreement that works to his injury in this context. So that's, I think, the key distinction the court has to recognize here. This isn't about permission slips. This isn't about authorization forms. This is about a waiver of a claim dealing with a fundamental property right that Minnesota courts are bound to protect and which the law of infant contracts extends special solicitude to. The second point that I want to speak to is the language of the waiver. And Judge Johnson, I think you hit the nail right on the head. All means all. And the clear language of this waiver does not in any way, shape, or form limit itself to negligence as Minnesota law requires. Now, I recognize opposing counsel tries to say, well, the word negligence does appear in terms of talking about the negligence of other participants. But that is the exception, so to speak, that proves the rule. In talking about the negligence of other participants, the agreement does not talk about the negligence of Pump It Up. And by specifying that as the only type of negligence that it's going to deal with, it is affirmatively saying that this document reaches far more broadly than Minnesota law allows it to. So based on clear statutory language, clear contract language, you have an agreement here that purports to excuse not just negligence, but also wanton, reckless conduct, et cetera, et cetera. And Minnesota law simply doesn't permit that. And if the court has doubts on that point, is saying, well, we've got a fair reading on one side and a fair reading on the other side. Well, guess what? That's ambiguity. And the other thing that an exculpatory clause can't be under Minnesota law, besides being overly broad, is it can't be ambiguous. So either this is overly broad in a clear way, or it's ambiguous. But either way, the agreement is unenforceable. Finally, I want to speak briefly to the waiver arguments that opposing counsel has been pressing before the court. And forfeiture. Once again, Judge Johnson,
you're referring to forfeiture now, not the waiver contract.
Forfeiture, not the waiver itself.
Yeah.
I'll keep the terminology clear, whether these grounds have been forfeited or not. Judge Johnson, I think you hit the nail right on the head here. The district court decided these questions and is owed deference on that point. It has made law for the parties. And the fundamental responsibility of a Minnesota appellate court is to determine whether what the district court did conforms with the statutes and the common law of Minnesota. So because the district court decided these questions, those questions are properly before this court on appeal and properly to be decided by this court. And the court only needs to look at cases like the Hanuskala case or the Moorhead versus Anda case, in which the Minnesota Supreme Court has emphasized time and again that even when counsel doesn't raise arguments, it does not absolve the court of the responsibility to make sure that the will of the legislature and the import of Minnesota law is carried out correctly in a case. And here, that means the liability waiver is unenforceable and that the district court erred in its assessment of Carter Justice's punitive damages amendment. Unless the court has any further questions.
It appears not. Thank you. Thank you to both attorneys for appearing in our Zoom feature for the Court of Appeals. A decision will be issued within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.